there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, discussion, debate, dialogue, and answers to your questions and emails. So I hope you'll stay tuned, but before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I have some emails to start out with today. The first email I want to do comes from Naomi in Santa Cruz, and she has questions about MRSA. That's methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. As a diagnosed community MRSA colonizee, I find myself in ever murkier and troubling waters. This sustained attack on my largest organ and immune system, my skin, is one aspect of MRSA that I've held my own against and been forced into my own advocacy. But the scarier aspect of community MRSA has been the treatment I've received at the hands of, and I'm going to skip the actual names of the doctors, the utter lack of interest shown, diagnosis given, or discussion generated in face-to-face visits, and therefore no clear plan of remedial action, has led me to an ever more fearful place. What is even more disconcerting, however, is in place of advice, I've been either judged to be of questionable mental stability or leading a druggy or questionable lifestyle and treated accordingly. As they ask no questions, order no tests, including no samples, they've also shown no interest in what I found to alleviate some of my symptoms in subsequent visits. So what's helped me is colloidal silver topically, acupuncture, mupirocin, which is Bactroban, less sugar and a more alkaline diet, and chlorine, either swimming or as a diluted solution. So my questions for you, Dr. Dawn, are these. Why are we being prescribed antibiotics for antibiotic-resistant staph? How do I keep skin staph from going systemic, where antibiotics will be my only hope? And is there any hope in winning the war against virulent bacteria? Thanks so much. I've come to very much appreciate, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So, Naomi, I read your whole email, which is a bit long because I wanted to set up the issue a little bit for people. And now I want to emphasize to the audience, this is my take on the situation. And we're going to start with a little story. This goes back maybe between 5 and 10 years ago now. I'd have to look up the patient's chart to know exactly when it was. But a patient came in, very healthy, athletic young man with a spider bite. And he was wondering about this spider bite because he'd had another one a couple of months earlier, which had healed. And looking at the spider bite, it looked exactly like a spider bite, red with a sort of black necrotic center. And running in my head, could he have brown recluse or some other kind of venomated spider bite? And well, anyway, just did a culture because wanted to be sure it wasn't infected. And it came back methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And that was the beginning of my exposure to the community-wide version of this, which has subsequently gotten out into the community and is now just anyone can get this. You can get it from the gym. You can get it from a perfectly normal-appearing, healthy person with no skin lesions. And we'll talk about more about that in a moment. In the meantime, in other settings, such as the drug-using community and most particularly the prison population, this bug has become virtually ubiquitous. I doubt that anyone comes out of prison without at least being colonized temporarily with MRSA anymore. It's just everywhere. So we have now two settings, prisons, institutional settings of all sorts should be included there, which would include more than likely any kind of foster care facility that's not a private home. Personally, I would think about convalescent homes. I'd think about any kind of group home. I'd think about hospitals. And the probability of finding higher levels of colonization in those settings is very great. So it's not exactly stigmatizing when half the population or a third of the population or even 10% of the population has something. We have to get over thinking of it as associated with prisons, et cetera. And I am sorry that Naomi got that kind of feeling from anybody. And I have to say that's bad education on the part of the doctors, probably younger doctors who, you know, really don't realize that this is a community issue. So what do we do about it? people can become colonized. Typically, they'll hold it in their nose and their ears and around the anus. So those three areas need to be cultured and cleared if we're going to eradicate it from an individual. If you're in a household, then that also means that your household associates, people who live with you in the same household, should at least have their nose swabbed, especially if you're having difficulty with eradication. And eradication is difficult. It requires several weeks of antibiotics orally combined with the use of a topical in the areas of colonization. So like I said, the nose, the ears, and around the anus are all areas where it will tend to persist. So those areas need to be treated directly. Use of antibacterial soaps during that time. And you've got to watch the laundry. You've got to watch the towels and the underwear. And basically, I suggest laundering those separately in a dilute bleach solution while you're trying to clear this bug. That's a lot of effort to go through. That's a lot of work. And whether or not it's strictly speaking necessary is a subject of great controversy in the medical community. And a lot of doctors don't suggest the 1 month of nasal mucosin or the other things I've talked about because it's just too much and they don't expect to get patient compliance. I certainly can't blame them for not being optimistic about patient compliance. But for someone like Naomi, who's truly creeped out and bothered by this, I think that's a motivated person who probably will go through the measures I've just outlined and stands a good chance of being able to clear it. Using this regimen, I have cleared this from numerous people and proved it by doing nasal swabs afterwards. So I know that this can work. And the question is re-exposure. And the question is, do we need to be going through that in the first place? At the moment, I think we probably do because we haven't figured out how to protect well from this. When it does get into the system, let's say the bloodstream, the lungs, it is very difficult to clear. Those are the antibacterials and antibiotics that we have. The new ones are the ones that this bug is resistant to. And finally, I want to just emphasize that not all methicillin-resistant Staph aureus is created equal. There are versions of this which are only resistant to a few antibiotics, and then there are some of the superbugs that we find in hospital settings that are really multi-drug resistant and extremely difficult it is to find an antibiotic to treat someone with a significant infection. And it's a moving target, obviously. So we have to look at sensitivities and understand that the community-acquired strain is not so dangerous as the hospital-acquired. So I hope this has been helpful. And just one last thing about methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. It's just like other Staph aureus. We all of us have some Staph aureus on our skin, and it's sensitive to most common antibiotics. Typically, if you become infected with Staph aureus, and I want to emphasize, Naomi is colonized, not infected. But if you become infected, you'll develop a boil or a red lesion of your skin. Often the center of this lesion will turn dark and scabby or ulcerate, and that's because the community-acquired methicillin-resistant Staph aureus has a toxin called valentin leucocidin, which will actually cause the skin in the center of the lesion to dissolve. It's a necrotic piece of flesh that happens in the center of the lesion. So it looks very much like a spider bite, and that's really what we look for. Multiple spider bites or recurrent spider bites should always be checked for this. Sometimes I've seen it just look like a pimple or a boil, but most often you do see that necrosis in the center. When it becomes systemic in the bloodstream, it's the same sorts of things you'd see in any bacterial sepsis. And Staph aureus in the lung is a very bad and dangerous infection to have. Typically, this is the infection that people get after influenza. So a post-influenza pneumonia, we need to think of that as Staph aureus until proven otherwise. And it's an extremely nasty thing in the lung because it damages the lung tissue very, very badly. So most of us who have MRSA are going to have it in our skin, and it's going to cause a pimple or, like I said, a boil with a necrotic center. The majority of people who have this will not get a skin lesion. They will look and feel perfectly normal, but if you swab their nose, they'll culture out as positive. So I hope that cleared it up. And let's go to our first caller, who is Kathy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Kathy, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don. Thank you very much. My question is, I'm getting a test by my medical doctor. I'm asking her to test for brain hormones, brain-regulating hormones, maybe I should say, serotonin, norepinephrine, and I asked her to test for GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. But when she was looking up the test she could do, she said there was nothing for GABA, and I asked her to then do serotonin if she could, because all the research I've done shows that my symptoms correlate to there being an off-balance of these hormones. I just wondered why there was no test for GABA, and I have one more question after that.
Well, the first response I want to make is that when you do a test for these neurotransmitters, you're not getting a true reflection of what's going on inside the brain.
Oh.
You're getting what's coming out either in the blood or the urine.
Right.
And since those neurotransmitters are manufactured in the brain, they're not manufactured and then transported by the blood to the brain like, let's say, glucose, which is not exactly manufactured, but at least it's in the bloodstream, and the blood glucose reflects the CNS glucose fairly directly. That doesn't happen with these neurotransmitters. So what you're looking at with any kind of testing, whether it's serum or urine, and I'm more familiar with the urine testing for these, is you're looking at breakdown products. And that's very indirect, okay, because the gut, the intestines are full of serotonin. And so the urine or the blood tests are not going to differentiate between brain serotonin and gut serotonin. You really don't know what you're seeing with those. I haven't found them clinically to be very useful tests. Deficiency syndromes, yes. I mean, if someone is really super deficient, but because of the gut serotonin issue, you know, if I see normal, I don't know if the brain is normal or if the intestines are just rounding out an abnormality. So I don't think it's a particularly useful test. And most of us go by symptoms and look at the syndrome. So, for example, if a person has an imbalance in serotonin, they might show typical symptoms of depression. They might have mood swings. They could have more of a bipolar picture. And unfortunately, what we're often doing in those situations is just using a drug to raise serotonin levels artificially and seeing if we get a clinical response. Very primitive. But we don't have the technology to look inside the brain chemically at this point.
Okay, so those tests aren't going to really show anything, it sounds like.
No, I haven't really found them useful. If you really read in terms of the testing literature, there isn't a lot of validation on those as being reflections of what's going on in the brain.
All right, well, thank you. There was one more question I had.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm getting tested again for heavy metals. I talked to you two or three weeks ago, really high lead and mercury and somewhat high thallium and rubidium. The medical doctor, she did some online research yesterday when I was in there, and she's going to give me a urine test. I told her that this was a provoked urine test with the chelator DMSA, and she said she doesn't want me to take the DMSA for this urine test. It's going to be a urine, not a blood test.
Right, right.
I'm wondering about the efficacy of this test.
Well, I suspect that what she's doing is getting a standard urine heavy metal screen, and that's recommended because if, for example, there was arsenic in your water or lead in your pipes, or let's say you were eating a lot of fish, then you might have a high mercury level because you ate a lot of mercury-laden fish the night before, but that doesn't mean that you necessarily have a lot stored in your fat. So you typically, when you do a provoked, you do a baseline and then a provoked. And part of the reason you do that is to prove that, in fact, the provocation did something. That there's something in storage, so to speak. That's the motivation. In general, I have found that the detection thresholds for the commercial tests, like that you might get at Quest or Lab One, are such that almost nobody ever tests positive for those, even if when I do a provoked on them, they've got pretty high levels. So if you go online and you search this, what you will find is recommendations to do this test. The trouble is some of those recommendations are not qualified well enough to address the nuances of the situation. So
that's what my ND told me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you are saying the same thing he was telling me, a different doctor.
Yeah, yeah, as in naturopathic.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, and that's a problem because what's taught in medical schools doesn't necessarily reflect what's known about these things. It reflects what's taught in medical schools. And not all of what's taught in medical schools is correct, by the way. Some of it's out of date, and some of it is, like I said, insufficiently nuanced. A good example of that would be the thyroid issue. So you'll have people who, they have all the symptoms of hypothyroidism, and they have a normal TSH. And at that point, from standard medicine standpoint, what's taught in medical schools, you're crazy. The patient's just crazy. They're, you know, diluted, it's psychosomatic, whatever. It's not their thyroid. And in fact, that's not true. And way back in medical school, you learned about this thing called euthyroid sick syndrome, EU. And if you go look that up, EU thyroid sick syndrome, it sounds like these people, they've got a normal TSH, but they have all the symptoms of hypothyroidism. And it's in, and you're taught in medical school that this is very rare. Actually, I think it's very common. And that's the difference, is that if you're taught that it's rare, then you don't look for it. And that's the piece of information that's incorrect that we're taught in medical school. And, well, you know, I don't believe it anymore because I've found that these are people who don't convert their thyroid peripherally. So their body tissues get a perfectly adequate supply of T4. And so their brain thinks the T4 level's fine. So their TSH is fine, their pituitary gland hormone signal. But these individuals are low thyroid functionally in their body tissues. And if you give them just a little bit of thyroid hormone, activated thyroid hormone called T3, they perk right up and all of their symptoms go away.
Oh, can I get that somewhere?
Sure. Just your naturopathic doctor can probably prescribe it for you. I'm not saying you need that.
No, I know you're not. I know. But I've also thought that I had symptoms of low thyroid in the past and they checked it and it looked all right. So I perked up when you were telling me about that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not unusual to have multiple things going on. This is I think this is a very, very common symptom in modern life. And I don't know if it's related to stress somehow, if chronic stress somehow interferes with peripheral conversion, but I sure do see a lot of impaired peripheral conversion and people do perk up. Sometimes you can just supplement them with iodine and micronutrients like selenium and they perk up. Sometimes you have to actually use the T3.
Okay. I'm going to talk to my ND about that. Thanks.
You're welcome.
So what do you think I should do then about this heavy metals test? Do you think that the best thing I can do under the circumstances, or should I get a blood test?
I think you need a baseline, and you're going to want to compare apples to apples.
So urine.
If you have a provoked urine, then you want a unprovoked urine to compare with.
Okay.
And I try to get them on the same day, because you can always
Yeah,
I know, it's a pain, but it would have been better to get it the first time. The reason for that is that somebody can always go back and say, well, you know, the reason it was high on Tuesday was you had all that swordfish the night before. A week and a half later, when you did the unprovoked, you hadn't had the swordfish, so that's why it was normal.
Yeah.
You see, you don't disprove that one unless you do them on the same day.
Oh, okay.
So I always check the urine, then give the provocation, and then check the urine.
Okay. Because I think you have to start doing the DMSH, like, 6 hours before, the night before, or something like that, I believe.
Yeah, but it's, you pee in a cup, you know, then you take the pill, then you pee
yeah,
some more.
That's true.
Not that hard.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're really welcome. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Craig in Watsonville.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling about my father. Since my mother passed away a couple years ago, he's been on his own. And since that time, he seems to have noticed that he gets these vivid dreams almost every night. They're dreams that date back probably, I mean, to a time period 50 years ago. He's about 89 now. So they date back to middle years, when he was in his middle years, in his 40s or so, about business and different activities. They're very vivid and they're intense and they wake him up. Mm. And he hasn't been able to, you know, he's on medications at this point in time, primarily for high blood pressure and cholesterol, and hasn't found anything that seems to correlate to this or any advice on what it might be.
He's not taking melatonin, is he?
No, he's not.
Okay, because that definitely can cause vivid dreams. That's one of the symptoms of that. And some of the sleeping pills and sedatives will cause you to have either no dreams or more vivid dreams. So one looks there. If there's a time when he can state when it started, I'd also look at whether or not his blood pressure medicines or his cholesterol medicines could be having an unusual side effect. So if there's, you know, a new drug that it was started around that time, and you can get the pharmacy, if you use the same pharmacy, it can tell you when you started a medication.
Okay.
Yeah, and if he is aware that, oh, it was after St. Patrick's Day in 2008 that these dreams started or whatever, if he can narrow that down, you may find a correlation there that would be worth exploring. In terms of whether or not the death of his wife has something to do with it, you know, causing...
Psychological, a
change in sleep pattern, you know, that a possibility. Yeah. You kind of implied that the way you asked the question.
Right. Well, that's the best when it started was after she died. So that seems to be, he doesn't recall having these dreams before then.
Mm-hmm. So that could be that his sleep pattern changed.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, sleeping more lightly now. That could be a manifestation of grieving or loss. I don't really have much solution except hypnotics, which I'm not thrilled with. So what I'd suggest for your father would be trying some herbal remedies and magnesium, for starters.
Okay.
Always good. Helps you stay asleep, so that could be helpful. 5-hydroxytryptophan is sometimes useful for prolonging sleep, so that could be a strategy. I like chamomile and passion flower, and you can find lots of tinctures of those things for sleep aids, and those are really good. And then valerian root is another one that's available as tincture that's quite sedating for some people. So you could maybe get the dose right on one of these or a combination of them that would help him sleep more deeply and not wake up from the dreams. He'll probably still have them, but if they don't wake him up, that's his sleep's not disrupted, so that could be okay.
Yeah, he is getting up a fair number of times during the night because of large prostate.
Mm-hmm.
So it may not happen, but yeah, okay. Yeah. One other question, if I may.
Sure.
He also, and this is not all the time, but once in a while he gets what he calls the wobblies. And he describes it as not really being dizzy, but being disoriented. And I'm not looking for a diagnosis at this point in time, but I'm wondering if you could suggest even things he could look out for to tell his doctor about when this happens. I talked to him, and he's really not even clear about exactly how he feels. If he sits down, it stops.
Okay. Right. That's an extremely important clue right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's blood pressure. I think what's happening, I think his blood pressure is dropping. You mentioned he's on some blood pressure medications.
Yeah.
He might need to reduce the doses of his meds. A lot of people, as they age, the reflex that keeps the blood coming back from your feet drops a little bit. So when prolonged standing or when you first stand up, you'll pool the blood in your ankles and then you aren't getting enough to your brain.
Yes.
And obviously blood pressure medications, some more than others, can aggravate this.
Well, he also does have blood circulation problems in his legs.
Right, but that's blood in, not blood back out.
Okay.
Anyway, the bottom line is that sounds like what we call hypotension.
Okay.
So orthostatic hypotension is the medical diagnosis, and I think that's what your father may have.
Okay.
And if he gets better when he sits down, that's like a... really, really likely. So getting him a blood pressure cuff that would automatically check his blood pressure. When he's feeling that way, having him stand up and check his blood pressure and then sit down and check his blood pressure.
Oh, okay.
Then I think what you'll see is that it will shift. And when he's sitting down and starts to feel better, he checks it again. And it's like, oh, okay, well, it's come up 15 points. And there you have it. The doctor can also probably check him in the office and demonstrate a big blood pressure drop with standing, even when he's not symptomatic from it.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Yeah, take care of that, though, because that can lead to falls.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. And let's take one more call. It's Bruce in Santa Cruz. Bruce, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm calling on behalf of a friend of mine who is currently 61 years old, 12 years ago had a significant embolic clot, and his left carotid artery was found to be completely occluded. During his rehab, he was placed on Coumadin. Now the question seems to be whether that Coumadin was initially prescribed in order to protect him against a continuation, an extension of a stroke, or whether it was prescribed as a prophylaxis against DVT or a PE. Now, 12 years later, he has been on Coumadin all this time, has done very well. His concern now and his reason to ask me to come in is he's pretty aphasic, having a lot of difficulty understanding the advice of his physicians. And he's very anxious about their new recommendation that he discontinue the Coumadin in favor of antiplatelet drugs. So I'm going to be going to a couple of appointments with him just to help him because the aphasia causes so much difficulty in communication with his physician. So we have an upcoming appointment with his PCP and also a hematologist. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if I could just kind of get some groundwork from you. He was found to have a factor 2 mutation after his stroke.
All right. So let's go back to the initial stroke.
Yes.
And he had an occluded carotid artery, and that was on the left carotid.
Correct.
His stroke would have then been to the left brain, which does fit with aphasia. The first question with your friend is if his stroke was thrombotic or embolic. And thrombotic stroke is where you block off the carotid artery with plaque, and that leads to a stroke. An embolic stroke, usually we use that to describe a stroke that comes from, say, atrial fibrillation or comes from a distance. And it tends to be smaller, but that's really an important distinction because if he's still at risk for stuff coming off of, let's say he has an erratic heartbeat, he has atrial fibrillation,
right,
then it's lifelong Coumadin. Now, because he has a factor 2 deficiency, he's more likely to form clots. And so the probability of getting an embolic stroke from atrial fibrillation is much higher than the general population. The antiplatelet drugs will not directly address a factor 2 deficiency. The antiplatelet drugs obviously address platelets. And an important thing to do there is that there is a polymorphism. That means that a common genetic variant where people don't have the enzyme to activate Plavix, which is the main antiplatelet drug that would be suggested in this gentleman. So he needs to be checked for the 2C19 enzyme to make sure that he doesn't have this genetic variant, which can be present in something like 5 to 10% of the population. So this is important to do before going off of the Coumadin. It should be standard of care, but it hasn't quite made it into standard of care yet, so sometimes it's done and sometimes it isn't, this test. It needs to be done for him as part of the decision-making process. As you age, the benefit from the Coumadin does drop. I don't quite know what his doctor's rationale is, and I don't have enough of the clinical picture to be certain that I would agree with the recommendations. So I can't, you know, second guess on insufficient information, don't want to do that. So the 2C19 test is important. Understanding what the nature of his stroke was in the first place, because you said embolic, but you've described thrombotic. That needs to be cleared up because
okay,
the recommendations are going to be different.
Right.
Okay?
Okay, thank you very much for your help.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And from my producer, just to make sure everyone else knows this, you can get a very clear web version of the show, which you can listen to directly, or download and play on any MP3 player, which would be any computer, plus all of those funny little boxes that people walk around with. So let's take a moment and cover a couple of interesting stories in the news. And this one, extremely important, so I want to get this one out there. This is a study looking at fish oil and breast cancer. So the old omega-3 fatty acids that are found in fish oil supplements, using 1,000 milligrams a day of this, a study just out at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle followed 35,000 postmenopausal women, no history of breast cancer, so relatively low risk, and they looked at their supplements and then followed them. In the course of the 6 years of the study, 880 women developed breast cancer. The risk ratio was 32% lower in women who were taking the 1 gram per day of fish oil. There were not a lot of other things that had that kind of reduction. This is from a press release, so I've not actually had a chance to see what else they were tracking in this study. So I will get back to you with that. But I'm going to be very interested in whether or not they were also looking at the use of supplements like broccoli sprouts or the diindolmethionine or indole-3-carbinol. Indole-3-carbinol has been one of the real hot stories as far as maybe this is the active ingredient in broccoli and Brussels sprouts that reduces cancer risk. And recently published study shed some light on a possible mechanism that I found quite fascinating. The usual explanation for the reason that broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables help prevent cancer is that they are supremely good at helping detoxify many compounds. They cause the body to upregulate those enzymes, like the enzyme I was referring to with the previous caller. And that upregulation gets rid of toxic stuff faster. This is good. And also changes the way estrogen is broken down, which is to say it makes it more likely to be a form of estrogen which cannot attach to and damage DNA. One of the breakdown products of estrogen can actually damage DNA, and that may account for some of the carcinogenic potential that we see in some individuals. However, this is a different mechanism entirely. In the course of a mutation occurring, I want us to take you down to the very level of the cell. In the course of a mutation occurring, the cell has proofreading mechanisms. And as the cell divides and makes a copy of the chromosomes so that each cell can have a full set, the proofreaders go through and they check and make sure that everything's correct. Now, there are mechanisms for literally stopping cell division and allowing for repair to take place if there has been a mutation. And that is where the indole-3-carbinol comes in. It turns out that there is an enzyme called, I'm going to tell you once, and then I'm going to use the abbreviation, cell division cycle 25A phosphatase. So we're going to call that CD25A. And in many cancers, this is overexpressed. And what this cell division cycle CD25A does is it prevents the cell cycle from stopping. It speeds up the cell cycle, basically disables the brake, and allows for that defective cell to get through the proofreading process, essentially forces the cell to divide before the cellular repair is complete, thus perpetuating mutations. In the case of breast cancer cells, and this is an in vitro and in vivo study, the researchers were able to show that indole-3-carbinol actually breaks down this CD25A and allows for its degradation. So you increase the degradation, you restore the cell back to a more normal setting, the cell division break now works, and cellular repair is able to take place. So this may be one of the reasons, not just getting rid of the bad stuff, but actually getting rid of the bad stuff at a cellular level, not just a liver level. So I thought that was really impressive. And between that and the fish oil story, I felt called to do a little science lesson. And we're going to... Hello, Mark, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, Mark, you're on the air. Hi, how are you?
Okay, I'll just go back. I got to give you a little history. I have chronic depression, and I have, for a long time, distrusted a psychologist and psychiatrist.
Did you say distrusted?
Yeah, I've never really had a good diagnosis. Mm-hmm. My problem. Now, last year, both my brothers died, and I've been homeless for probably about last year. Part of it, I was living at one of my brothers before he died, and then I got quite a few bad situations, and people would say, hey, you know, you need to go and get help. I just wouldn't. I thought I could handle it. Mm-hmm. And when it got so bad that I was contemplating suicide, I called Access, and they convinced me that I need to change my beliefs a bit and not have so much distrust for psychiatrists.
Well, Mark, a lot of times diagnosis, especially since we don't have blood tests and we don't have good brain imaging where I can just, you know, run you through the MRI machine and say, oh yeah, there you've got schizotypal affective disorder. See, it's right there on the scan. You know, we don't have that kind of technology. And so when your brain's messed up in any way, it doesn't matter whether you're intoxicated or whether you have a neurotransmitter problem or a structural issue, one of the things that is impaired is your ability to communicate, to interpret social cues, and sometimes environmental cues. So you're naturally going to have a distortion in either the way you take things in or in the way you put things out. And people are trying to read through that distortion and use it to figure out exactly what the diagnosis is. But ultimately, I don't know that diagnosis matters very much because we've only really got about three categories of drugs. You know, we've got the antipsychotics, which are, there's the old one, you know, Thorazine, and then there's all the children of it, and now we have all of these new atypical antipsychotics. They're good drugs. They can be extremely useful and life-transforming, but they all have side effects, and essentially it's kind of a crapshoot. You try an agent, and you see if you improve the clinical situation for the patient after a few weeks, and then if you don't, you try a different agent. And, you know, when people get to their third or fourth drug and they're having side effects and they don't feel any better, there's a tendency to just chuck the whole thing. And
no, excuse me, doctor. This is the question is this. While I'm waiting to speak to a psychiatrist, which is through Mental Health America, and I find them, I kind of like the professionalism, but then I started using St. John's wort, and the instructions say to mix it with water or juice. And there's been times I didn't want to do, and I squirt it under my tongue. I want to know, is that accepted? Is that safe, or is that not a good thing to do?
I think St. John's wort is a really, really safe agent. So whether you put it in your mouth, in your GI tract, or use a sublingual, I don't think there's any significant risk for doing that. I really don't. Where you run into problems with St. John's wort is if you're on it, and then you mix it with other agents. So there's certain antidepressants, for example, which are called MAO inhibitors. You mix that with St. John's wort, you could get toxic. But in general, if that's the only agent you're using, it's extremely safe.
Yeah, well, I really intend to mention my use of St. John's wort to the psychiatrist.
You should mention it, yes. Yeah, that's very important. So is that the main question that you had? And I guess I want to make sure that I've answered your question.
Yes, I believe you have.
All right. I want to encourage you to keep reaching out because, first of all, I think it stinks that people end up homeless at all. I mean, I think that the so-called richest and most advanced society in the world should be able to figure that one out. And certainly you don't sound like somebody who's homeless by choice because you're a rebel without a cause. You sound like somebody who'd be perfectly happy to accept some subsidized housing and get a roof over your head. So I just want to say that I'm really sorry for your personal situation, and I hope things get better.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. John.
Bye. Let's talk to Robin in Watsonville. Hello, Robin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. So earlier you were talking about how widespread the MRSA has become.
Yes.
And especially you mentioned, you know, it's not just isolated to the prison population.
No.
You know, but you can pick it up other places. And so that really made me wonder, you know, are some people more susceptible to picking this up, and how could it be prevented, or, you know, where might colonies harbor? You mentioned they have a human host, you know, and how are they passed on? And,
right.
You know, is there anything that we should do, you know, to protect ourselves against encountering this?
Well, yes, there are. And it's essentially the sorts of protective measures that your mom told you about, you know, wash behind your ears. I'm not being totally facetious there, because the ears, particularly the ear canal, is one place where you can be colonized. So good personal hygiene, cleaning your body on a regular basis. When I go to the gym, I always get a little creeped out because the first five people I saw with MRSA got it from the gym, probably. I mean, they were all athletic, young, healthy people who hit the gym a couple of times a week. And that has made me be a little bit self-conscious about going to the gym, actually. And I tend to sit on a towel. I bring my own towel, and I put that towel on the gym equipment. And then when I'm done with my, if I have a cut, paper cut or anything, I have a Band-Aids in my gym bag, and I make sure I cover up any breaks in my skin. And I do the same thing at the hospital and at my medical clinic because, you know, what do you find at hospitals? You find sick people with germs. And so I don't want breaks in my skin being exposed to those germs. I don't want to infect anybody, and I also don't want anybody to infect me. So those are precautions that you can take that would make a lot of sense to me. And then don't just go home in your gym clothes and shower when you get home. Shower at the gym and change into a fresh set of clothes.
So, maybe the school environment for children could also be a potential site.
I think so.
You were saying that it looks like a spider bite, so does it itch also?
yeah, it can itch a little bit. But the main thing about it is it's tender, it's sore when you're infected. But when you're colonized, it's no symptoms at all.
All right.
And so,
thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
On the MRSA, it's very, very creepy. It's like the Red Menace, you know, they could be anywhere. And we have to kind of get over that a little bit. I'm not trying to make everybody paranoid. Good personal hygiene's a good idea for a lot of reasons. Where I think it is super, super important is if you do have an index member or person in the household who is colonized or who has had MRSA, you need to make sure they don't still have it, they aren't colonized. And that is important. And I don't think we do enough nasal swabs in treated patients to confirm months out that they're still disease-free, or rather that they're not colonized any longer. I shouldn't say it's a disease. It's not a disease in that circumstance. And again, remember, we all have some Staph aureus on our bodies. That's normal. It's just that we want to have the least drug-resistant Staph aureus we can, and the drug-resistant one is less desirable for the reasons that should be obvious. Let's go to Mezzo in Watsonville. Hello, Mezzo. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. I love your show. I listen every single week.
Excellent.
I had a friend this week who suddenly died of what looks like an aneurysm, and she had been sick for a couple weeks with a headache, and it started with like vomiting and diarrhea, and then it went to just sort of general feeling sick, and then just a headache for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And she had gone to, like, you know, the cosmic healer people. And then she went to a doc in the box. They wanted to do an MRI and a CAT scan. And, of course, she didn't have insurance and didn't do those.
Mm-hmm. And she
now
died.
She's dead.
Yep.
Yeah. So are those, like, symptoms that are generally with an aneurysm?
Yeah, they definitely can be. What an aneurysm is it's a blood vessel wall that's stretched open. And a lot of times it's just initially stretched out and it'll break like a run in a nylon stocking, and a little bit of blood will come out, just a little bit of blood. And that's called a sentinel bleed. Now that little bit of blood, like, you know, sentinel as in the guardian who's, you know, out there on the periphery, that little bit of blood gets into the CSF, the fluid, and it's very irritating to the meninges. And so the person gets essentially a meningitis headache. And they may, and that's the headache. And often it will trigger nausea and vomiting. So people will vomit, which isn't great because when you vomit, you're retching and you're increasing potentially the intracranial pressure by doing that. But it's a symptom. So when a person suddenly gets nausea and vomiting and headache, the medical establishment has trained us very well in this regard to recognize that that's potentially a bleed and to send the person down for a CT scan. And I personally had that hammered into me as a medical student, and it actually saved the life of my nurse who was working for me and got this sentinel bleed.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, this is probably just stress, but you're getting a CT scan. And it wasn't stress, as it turns out. And I am just eternally grateful to my teachers. And, you know, I diss conventional medicine a lot. I'm always talking about its shortcomings. And I need to give it credit where credit is due. And we're really good at figuring out the immediate, devastating, life-threatening stuff. And I am so sorry that she wasn't scanned. And you know what would have happened if she'd gone to an ER is that she might have gotten the scan. More than likely she would have done, because the emergency room wouldn't let her go without doing it. And when she got that scan, they would have seen some blood, more than likely. You can also do a lumbar puncture and see blood down in the spinal column. And I actually had a really strange headache once, and I went to the ER and asked the ER doc to go ahead and do a spinal tap on me because I was really worried, and that's a more reliable way than the CT scan. And he did, and it was negative, and I felt much better, and it turned out to be just stress in my case. But,
well, that's exactly what she thought it was just stress from her job and stress for, you know, that kind of stuff. And she just kept thinking it would get better.
Yeah, and basically, rule of thumb, if you get headaches from stress, you'll know that by the time you're 25. So if you're under 25 and you get headaches from stress, and this headache is like your stress headache, then you probably don't have to go to the urgent care. you're over 25 and you don't usually get stress headaches, or this is distinctly different from your stress headache, or if you have a sudden onset of headache followed shortly thereafter by nausea and vomiting, that one is really bothersome. Headache, then nausea, not good. And the nausea tends to be a central nervous system nausea rather than a stomach nausea. And how do I describe that? When you get a bug, when you get gastroenteritis that's going to make you nauseate, you've got diarrhea, you've got churning, you push on, your stomach's gurgling like crazy, you push on your stomach and it hurts. Those are all signs that you got a bug in your gut. When you've got central nausea, you don't have any gut symptoms. You just feel queasy and want to throw up. And so it's different. And when you've got that non-gut want to throw up and a headache, it doesn't really matter. I mean, what if you go into debt? I mean, it's better than being dead.
Yeah, I get that.
And sure. I'm so sorry that happened. That's a terrible story.
Yeah, it was very sudden and sad. And, you know, she was important to the community and everybody's going to really miss her.
Well, maybe you're coming on the air and telling that story will save somebody else someday. So
that's what I'm hoping. It definitely taught me that, you know, I don't have insurance, but I could get an MRI or a CAT scan if something was going on. Yeah. But, you know, some people can't, and that's what's so screwed up.
Yes. Well, we just have to hold our breaths and our noses until 2014 now. At least we're on a countdown, assuming they don't repeal it. But, you know, even if they repeal the mandate, I think that would be a very bad thing. But, you know, realistically, it could happen, especially if Congress turns, you know, things are not great in the country right now. So we could see an upset there. And if we get another upset in the House or the Congress is less Democratic and more Republican, we probably will certainly have an active challenge to the bill. If they repeal the mandate, it's going to be much more expensive. But we've still got some things in that bill that will be very helpful, including the no pre-existing conditions and the insurance pools, which means that we probably will have affordable health care insurance.
Right.
And it may not be as affordable as it would be if everyone was in the pool, but at least it'll be something. And
I just applied for insurance on Friday. I was like, yeah, I can't. I'm 60. I don't want to be running around here with no insurance like I have been. I've been very lucky up to now, but I don't, all of a sudden, it's like, no, get some insurance, Mezzo.
Yeah. Mezzo, get the $10,000 deductible, and then it's like, okay, so I have to come up with $10,000 to pay off the ER bill and the MRI. Yeah, it'll take you 2 or 3 years to pay that off, but at least you aren't going to lose your house.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking, too. I don't want to lose everything just because I end up in an ER someday.
Or if your friend had gone to the ER and her aneurysm had been diagnosed, she would have had to have had very expensive therapy. They would have probably done a coiling if they could have gone in there with tubes through the arteries, gone up into the brain and basically plug the aneurysm up, put a coil in there. That sort of thing is hugely expensive. And she would have had a big bill, but she would have been alive.
Late for her.
Not too late for all of us, though. So I'm glad you're moving forward and things will get better. Okay.
And I'm hoping that other people will hear this. And if they get those symptoms, you know, don't mess around. Don't think it's just a stress headache, maybe. Especially if it's like, you know, lasts more than a week.
Yeah. A couple days is a long time for a headache. Thank you, Mezzo, for the call.
Thank you very much for your show. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we're coming up on the end of the hour, and I want to thank you all for listening. It's been grand, and I hope you'll come back next week, and we'll talk more about various healthcare issues as well as a science lesson that I'm preparing on more on cancer mechanisms. So stay tuned for that. Tune in next week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.